His skin is white just like a ghost. Thick Irish roots and his blonde hair. And he sounds like a Chicago super fan. A music nerd with a collection of CDs from here to there. Yes, Andy Dare is in Chicago, interviewing and barbecuing. It's the Andy Dare Show. It's the Andy Dare Show.
Welcome to the Andy Dare Show. I'm your host, Andy, and today it is episode 158. It is our Year in Rock 2015, and I am joined by Stephen Thomas Erlewin. He is senior editor at Rovi and All Music Guide, allmusic.com. Do check it out. He's been a friend of our shows for the last couple years now. Real knowledgeable guy, has my dream job, but really nice guy, knows a ton about music. We just barely scratched the surface here. But, yeah, it's a nice discussion. I give you my top 20 lists. And, yeah, we talk with Tom Erlewin about my top 20. We also talk about Scott Weiland. We talk about streaming services. We talk about the music industry in general for 2015. I thought it was a banner year as far as actual music being released. You could also say it was a bad year as far as the music business. But, All that matters is, did you like the music that was released this year? And I definitely did. I've got 20 awesome albums for you to check out and support the arts, support these people. Either go on Amazon and buy the 20 albums that I mentioned. And if you want to support the Andy Dare Show, go to andydare.com, click through our Amazon banner, and then we can support ourselves as well. And you spend zero extra dollars. So that's andydare.com, click through the Amazon link. And I'm pretty sure you can find all the 20 albums I listed over there on Amazon. And yeah, it's a great service. I ordered something the other week, and the music came within 2 days, and I paid the used price, and guess what? They were brand new, never touched. So it's nice. Amazon's a great little thing, and it's nice that we have this working relationship. Also, if you want to support our show, check out my brand new album. And yeah, it's got music from me. I do a little cover of a Guided by Voices song, 14 Cheerleader Cold Front, and also bits from the show from the past couple years. Cool stuff with Jack and Dino, Stephen Drozd of the Flaming Lips, Dave Markey, the guy who directed 1991, The Year Punk Broke. Lots of cool little bits and interesting, colorful characters from the show. Yeah, it's called Service with a Smile, and that can also be found at andydare.com. It'll lead you right to our Bandcamp page. Right now, it's only $5. You can just send it as a gift. They'll put it right in your friend's email, and it's nice. We've been doing this show for almost 5 years now, and it's just an interesting way to support the show and help out everybody involved. So thank you to anybody who has clicked on the Amazon link or who has supported the Service with a Smile album. And yeah, it's been a great year. I want to thank all the new listeners we've got. Want to thank everybody who's helped on the website, andydare.com. Want to thank Giovanni Giorgio for helping us move servers. Got a nice little new studio here in the basement, and that's because of the Amazon click-throughs. We couldn't have done it without you. Not a whole lot I need to mention before this. We got a whopping, I think it's about an hour-long chat with Stephen Thomas Erlewin. Lots of cool talk about the whole year of rock music, box sets, streaming services, what's new, news in general. It's a nice little chat. Want to thank Tom Erlewin for taking the time out. Want to thank you for spreading the word and telling a friend about the Andy Dare Show. Want to thank everybody at Dare Network. The Jay Porks Experience from Staten Island, New York, every Tuesday. He's been doing it for a couple years now. Want to thank Jay Porks for bringing such an awesome podcast to Dare Network. You can find it every Tuesday at andydare.com. How about Jesse Unplugged? Jesse Corgan, brother of Billy Corgan, and just an all-around nice guy, an ex-wrestling heel. He is a very interesting guy with tons of stories. That's Jesse Unplugged, and that's once a month at AndyDare.com. And Tyler Kale in our Spin Class podcast, where we dissect a hip-hop classic from the 80s and early 90s. That's a couple times a month. That's called Spin Class Podcast. Once again, check it out at AndyDare.com. And the way we can keep bringing you this awesome free content is just by telling a friend, supporting the Service with a Smile album, or clicking through the Amazon banner for your Christmas shopping. And thank you so much to everybody who's supported us. We're the little guy over here, and it means a whole lot to us that you keep on checking out the new episodes and the new shows, and we're going to keep it up. We got an interesting 2016 lined up, and big news, can't really divulge too much right now, but right now, why don't we get into our Year in Rock 2015 with special guest Stephen Thomas Erlewine. Hey everybody, thank you so much for checking out the Andy Dare Show. Today it is episode 158, and like all good traditions, we have back on the show for a little Year in Rock wrap-up, Stephen Thomas Erlewine. How you doing?
All right, how are you doing, Andy?
I am doing well, and yes, it's been, actually I think it's been a great year in rock. You know, it's great when it's hard to whittle it down to 20. Any thoughts, just like a basic overview of this year? I mean, a lot of good stuff coming out, and even people are always, you know, singing sad songs about how the music industry is going down the toilet. But with quality work coming out, I mean, I can't be one to join into that, you know, sad song about it. So,
well, I always think that there's you can easily be cynical and say that there's, you know, there's no Led Zeppelin or No Who or whatever, but you think it's a little bit tired because you're looking for what's not there instead of what is there. And there's a bunch of good stuff from both new bands and even some of those old guys. So it's just, you know, it's, you have to open yourself up and hear it. And there's a lot of stuff going on out there.
Exactly. I mean, it shows the wide variety of awesome music when you've got Keith Richards putting out like a pretty groundbreaking work the same year as Kendrick Lamar is being called the best song of the year by the President of the United States. So,
Obama's playlist, which may not all be on his shoulders, but you know, if it's him and the combination of the White House, was actually nicely balanced and had a lot of interesting selections, including one of my current favorite bands, Low Cut Connie. So that was
Nice, really. Yeah. He's digging deep, or maybe one of his staffers are. But
exactly.
Yeah, but George W. Bush, I couldn't think of what his, he'd probably think Molly Hatchet or something. I couldn't even tell you what he would pick. But yeah, we got a lot of stuff to get into. Last week we had pretty much a bombshell dropped on us, even though no one really it wasn't unexpected for anybody really. Scott Weiland passed away at the age of 48, and you know, he never really got the respect that I believe he was due, because you have a new article out that you wrote for the Medium, right? Medium.com?
Yeah, correct.
And I really like how you shed a little bit of light about how STP were the first to use Brendan O'Brien as their producer, and then Pearl Jam would go and use him on Verses. And even though the whole story was that STP was a Pearl Jam ripoff, but I like how you shed a little bit of light on the other side of that story. Yeah,
no, that, it is pretty fascinating that, especially at the time that STP was tagged as Pearl Jam ripoffs, and there's some sort of, you know, similar vocal styles from Weiland and Eddie Vedder, but Brendan O'Brien hadn't really produced a hit until Core, and then I think that the production on Core is actually better than 10 in a lot of ways. 10 has great songs and it's a very distinctive sound, but I find it a little bit too soft and sort of amorphous, particularly with the emphasis on the fretless bass. But with
glossy,
Core, Core has lots of shade and light, as Jimmy Page used to call it, and Brendan O'Brien and Stone Temple Pilots continue to work that way together, But it clearly, Pearl Jam heard this because they hired O'Brien for verses and worked with him ever since. And to O'Brien's credit, he works with them in distinct different ways and really zeroes in what made the bands unique.
Sure, he brings out the muscle as well with the Kretz and DeLeo rhythm section. It's funny, though, yeah, in the first couple STP albums, Weiland's definitely got almost a, not a country-ish vibe to his voice, but more of a Americana or Heartland. I guess maybe that's kind of where the Vedder comparisons came in. But then about around the number four album is when he really started finding the Bowie in his voice. And finding, I think his big breakthrough vocally was the song Atlanta on the number four album, the last track on the album.
Yeah.
It is somehow a combination of Sinatra, like Jim Morrison and Bowie combined. And it's just, it was never played on the radio. I don't know if they even did that one live very much, but I think I've been digging that one up as an homage to the man. And that is just a complete classic work of art.
I really think that it's interesting to me. It seems like they hit the accelerator pedal sometime between Core and Purple, and Purple's a little uneven, but the highs are as good as anything that the band or Weiland ever did. And then Tiny Music gets even more adventurous, and I'm actually a fan of the 12 Bar Blues album.
Love it, yeah.
Fellow record from '97, and it's he certainly worshipped Bowie, and just both for like the timbre of the voice and the phrasing, but he picked up like a lot of Kurt Weill from Bowie as well. And so it's fun to hear how he filtered that through, because he also liked a lot of sort of trashy glam stuff, which was fun. And I wound up listening to the Talk Show album, which I haven't heard in probably almost 20 years.
Wow,
and that's
me too.
Yeah. It's actually not a bad record, but you really see what the two of them brought together. They had real chemistry, and you have to feel for all involved. You know, certainly Weiland had his demons, but you also feel for the rest of the band, because I think that all they wanted to do was tour and make records, and they just couldn't do it.
Yeah, especially nowadays when you really need to hit the road and play some concerts. When your singer's in a position where he can't do it, you're pretty much forced at this point to find a replacement. Chester, I mean, I've heard he's really good-hearted, a nice guy, a hard worker, has all the things that Scott maybe didn't possess, but I don't think Chester possessed that thing that Scott had, where it was kind of like you're never sure if what Scott you're going to get, which the little bit of danger makes it exciting. When he does come through, it's better than anything you've ever heard. And it was weird because I heard his last interview saying that Chester had just stopped working with STP and that there was now a position available. And it seemed like Scott was at a content place where he might finally be able to go back into the fold and, you know, be able to play these songs that he helped create, you know, 20 years ago.
It's kind of interesting that they were drawn to Chester, because he's pretty much the complete opposite in so many ways from Weiland. And there's also kind of the appeal to that as well, because you'd probably want someone a little more stable. And but it just doesn't seem to jibe with a lot of the DeLeo's strengths. And so, like, Chester's not a particularly hooky melodic writer for all of his attributes. That's not necessarily one that I identify with him. But it's also odd. Like, that was part of the problem with Velvet Revolver for me, was that Weiland and the Guns N' Roses guys come from different backgrounds in a lot of ways. You know, Weiland never really went for a lot of that bluesy sleaze kind of thing. So it always felt like they were butting heads.
He didn't fit on the Sunset Strip sound as much as he tried for the Velvet Revolver.
No.
They were good albums. They were not classics the way that Purple and Core are. I think the Chester thing is that after 20 years, the DeLeo brothers just wanted a guy that would show up on time, sign autographs, be completely with it, and I think that's what they got for 3 or 4 years, and I'm sure it was a success. Most overall, it was a success, I'm sure. But
That's also my theory behind Miles Kennedy and Slash, is that, you know, Miles Kennedy is no great shakes, but, you know, he's probably a nice guy that shows up on time.
Yep, exactly. And how about the Wildabouts? It's just such a weird story how the guitarist OD'd when the album came out back in May or March, and then this happens to Scott. Then the bassist gets arrested with possession. And it turns out that bassist, Tommy Black, he is the manager at the Viper Room, where the River Phoenix fiasco went down 20 years ago. And it just seems like it's just all a ploy just to let Scott do what he wants to do on the tour bus.
Such a small world.
And it's actually not a bad album. I actually went out and bought the album, which I'm sure millions of people did this week. And not a great album, but not bad by any means. There are a handful of nice compositions. Weird to see James Iha pop up out of nowhere on the album. But yeah, not a great way to go out, but not a terrible turd of a failure. Which
I kind of like it a little bit better than the Happy and Galoshes record. Like there's some really fun things on it, and Art of Anarchy, which Scott wound up disowning, he's actually pretty good on it, and that's almost sort of instructive where you see. The Disturbed guys and Bumblefoot, you know, they want to push in this certain active rock direction, which is all, like real rock for them.
Sure. Yeah.
But that's just not the way that he wants to go. Like he was always just slightly left of center. And so I think that's why he was, didn't really fully embrace the Art of Anarchy, even though he sounds really good on it. He gives it a lift that you see listen to other active rock bands and they don't have that kind of charisma. So.
Nice. That's one I have to check out. I did see it was released like 2 months ago to no fanfare.
Yeah, he tried to shut it down, if I remember right.
Nice. But he has a tribute. You got to check out what the last things that he released. That's always a thing I like to go back with. But yes, a lot of other stuff happened in the year. This will be our little end of year wrap up. And big thing happened in the middle of the year. The release date changed from Tuesday, as it has been since I can't even remember when it's been different, to Friday. And
I think that the Tuesday wound up being instituted in the late 80s.
In the late 80s. Okay, gotcha. And I talked to a manager at the Reckless Records chain here in Chicago, and they were really bummed about it. And I go, how come you're bummed about it? And they go, when they sell out of something on Friday, they have to wait till Monday to get the next shipment. They can't get it the next day like they could have got it on Wednesday when they sold out of something on a Tuesday. So it really stuck in their craw. I'm indifferent to it too much, even though I still go out and I do buy stuff on the release dates. Around me, all I got is Best Buy, Target, and Barnes & Noble, and then, you know, a couple mom-and-pop stores.
I don't think you're much different than the rest of the world at this point.
Yeah, and it's almost like the smoking section with CDs. They're making it smaller. They're putting it in the corner. Pretty soon you're going to have to go buy the CDs outside. They don't have room in the store for it. And but I'm still.
But did you wind up talking to the Reckless guy before or after the change of release date?
It was actually right when it happened. It was for the New Order album, or it was about a month or so after it happened. It was the New Order album. They sold out of their stock, wanted to reorder, couldn't get it till Monday. So,
yeah, I heard a lot of people were voicing those complaints prior to the institution of the release date, and I've been curious whether it's played out that way in actuality. I sort of suspected that it was, and it sounds like it is, because it's a genuine problem for retail, because you used to get a spike of the hardcore fans on Tuesday or Wednesday, and then you would replenish to have stuff for the weekend, and now you would just get sell out right away in time for the weekend. So it's sort of designed for more digital distribution, like for people at work or sometime during somewhere during, like during they're just able to stream or purchase a download, and that's sort of the start of their weekend. Digital over physical.
Yeah, I mean, like my guy would get, I have a Kinect, which would get me it on Friday for Tuesday. And now I go to him, I go, I'm totally confused now. I have no idea. And then he said, yeah, him too. He doesn't know when he'll get it, but usually a week before or something like that. I think it's more of a destination, go out on the weekend and go to your record store on a Friday or Saturday. I think that's kind of nice having something brand new and fresh to sell to the people. But, yeah, I mean, I guess I'm not a manager at a record store, so I don't have a horse in that game, right?
Well, how does it change you for you as a fan? Like, do you find it like doesn't feel as much fun to have it on a weekend, or you'd prefer to have it on a Tuesday, or does it not matter much one way or the other?
Well, when I was a teenager, I would get the thing on Sunday for like the ads for the new album, and it would be for Tuesday, and then it seemed like kind of a long, a devastating long wait for till Tuesday to come around when it was really just 2 days away.
Right.
But now it's a little bit died down, so I'm okay with the Friday release. I think that's a good thing for the.
You're more mature.
Yeah, I've aged a little bit, so I can wait till Friday. And yeah, I did see a tweet and a little bit about the death of the CD and how it's not the death that people are saying. It is still the leader in the marketplace. Is that
well,
true?
Well, you see, this is the thing that kind of bugs me about coverage of where we are with transition to streaming or away from physical product. It's often painted as a binary solution, like there's just one kind of audience and one kind of listener that you're able to show transition everybody from purchasing CDs to listening to online, which I don't think is necessarily true, and I don't think that we should rush to abandon CD sales, which, you know, still amount for like $500 million. Like if you're the record company, you're not going to give that up. Just even if you're raking more money in through streaming, you still get $500 million through CD sales alone. And I think it's a 200 million for vinyl. And I think downloads, you know, they haven't disappeared either. There's this compulsion to say that it's all all cratering, but that's not really the case. What's happening is that it's a slow shift, and then you're also going to find that there's some people are very rabid fans of collecting CDs or vinyl, or some people only need streaming, some people will do a hybrid. And since it really makes no sense to just cut something off completely for the idea of working toward the future.
It's a foolish thing to always be looking for the next thing. I had a story about a record store closing in Chicagoland about 1993, and they had to rent dumpsters to dump vinyl. They said, vinyl? What are we going to do with vinyl? It's all CDs. It's all the compact disc now. It's all Discman and every, you know, portable music. Who will want vinyl? Flash forward to 20 years, and it's probably even eclipsed the CD at this point. And for people dumping out their CDs and stuff like that, who knows, in 10 years it might be the kitsch new thing to get your CD and your Discman and your headphones and go for a walk. Who knows, right?
Well, it's quite possible. And another thing that I, you know, there's different audiences. Like, I don't think that everybody that bought Adele in the millions and millions that did are necessarily interested in hearing all possible albums for $10 a month. They want to buy one album for $10.
That's true. Yeah, that is true.
they're fine with that. So I think that you can't force people to continue to pray for streaming if they're just going to be perfectly happy with listening to one record. You know, it's just people listen to things in different ways, and also you're going to have people that have considerable financial restrictions too. Like maybe they don't want to spend $10 a month. Maybe they don't have access to Wi-Fi. So, you know, there's there's a bunch of different factors that suggest that there's going to be plenty of different audiences for a long time.
It's true. And yeah, there's a lot of naysayers out there about the streaming services, how they, you know, pay pennies on this, you know, not even a cent for per play or all that stuff. And YouTube, I mean, a lot of kids just play their music on YouTube, and you know, we'll play the commercial along with it. Somebody who didn't make that song is getting, you know, a little bit of payment for you know, having people check out that song on YouTube. Is YouTube trying to make a music service? Is that what I heard? Or?
That is true. It's going to be a subscription service that's not just music, but also for videos as well. And so I think that it's, you know, it's possible that it would wind up being something very useful, or it might just be something that is only for us. It might be like somebody that wants like a buffet, like they
sure.
want both video and music. It might not be the kind of targeted thing that Apple Music or Spotify is, and that's interesting to keep in mind.
I was going to ask you, what streaming services do you use? I do Spotify here and there, but I don't pay for the services, just because I just do it. If I open it up on social media or something like that, I'll listen to something. Apple Music, I tried the little 3-month trial of it and was pretty unamused by it. As far as me, whenever I'll check for something if they have it. If they don't have it, maybe I'll give them 5 times. If they don't have something that I want to hear 5 times in a row, then I'm pretty much canceling my subscription. How about you? What do you go for?
I have at one point subscribed to most of these services for a little while to just test them out. And I'm currently subscribing to Spotify and Apple Music, and the catalogs are pretty much the same, so it all becomes a question of interface and slight different features, because Apple Music will have exclusive albums. They'll have the Dr. Dre or the Eric Church, but it also is a slightly friendlier interface, I think. Plus, it also has Beats One, which I think is a pretty good radio station.
Oh, sure.
Spotify, I think, is not as warm an interface, but their weekly recommended playlists are quite nice, and I find that they're assembled with quite a bit of thought, and they're pretty accurate according to what I've been listening to through there. So I find that they're both beneficial, and there's also some neat things like that I would wind up streaming, say, the new Live Jam Box that's out only in the UK, but it's showing up on streaming services.
Nice. Okay.
So, you know, like for me, both for the work that I do and the personal entertainment, it certainly pays off for the top. I can totally understand that there's groups of people, including hardcore music people, that might never find it that enticing. They might not need to either check out the new Grimes or find this new Mickey Dolenz 70 singles collection. And those are the things that I find appealing about streaming services. And, Apple Music interface might be a little bit better. I also like the social aspect of Spotify. I like that, I make playlists and share them. I did a Weiland's playlist, and I have a Yacht Rock playlist that keeps getting new followers.
Nice.
And that's a nice thing. I also like to subscribe to a friends list to see what they're doing. So that pushes it over the edge to an extent as well. And I think that Tidal actually gets a bad rap. It's really not that bad of a service. It does sound better than Spotify or Apple Music, especially if you're running it through Sonos.
Nice.
It's just a little more expensive, and I can understand why there's reluctance to it, and maybe they had some bad marketing decisions. That said, I think there's definitely room for a high quality audio streaming service. And so maybe they'll still be around at some point.
Very cool. And then how about Pono? No, I'm kidding.
Well, Pono's
is it out yet? Or?
Yeah, it's been out for a while, and it's I've played around with it, but I don't have one, and it sounds good, but I think that's because it has a preamp in it.
Okay,
and
gotcha.
So it essentially is a preamp that's going to be able to play your high-quality digital files, and so it has an equalizer built in, and you can't get under the hood, which a lot of audiophiles like to do. So it's for people that just want to plug and play.
Nice.
Either through headphones or putting it into your own stereo system. It sounds really good. It's I find it in an awkward shape.
Like a Toblerone, right?
Yeah, I find that quite awkward. But it sounds good. If you want an easy audiophile service, it's not a bad way to go.
So did they give you one to test out, or have you not? Have you held one in your hand?
No. I've held one in my hands at South by Southwest last year. I did a test run, and I wound up doing a feature where I spoke to Neil Young, and that ran on radio.com last year.
Wow, so. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
I was going to say one thing that streaming services, they're not good for me, the box set, because I need the liner notes. I need that big chunk to hold in your hand. It feels great. I have probably 25 box sets. They're near and dear to me. I bought a good box set from this year. I've heard that the new Springsteen, the River, that the blown up version. What is it? 6 CDs, 2 DVDs, 3 DVDs?
It's it's either two Blu-rays, 3 DVDs, and 5 CDs.
Nice.
So two CDs of original album, and then there is a CD, the original single album that he submitted and withdrew prior to making The River a double album. It was going to be a single disc called The Ties That Bind. Here it's called The River Single Album Edition. And then The Ties That Bind as the title for double disc collection of outtakes, and it's really excellent stuff all the way through. It's my personal Springsteen record, probably because it sprawls and it has like the simplest rock and roll that he ever did, and I think that's a lot of fun. And
he's doing shows that are just based on The River. I think he's going to do The River in its entirety, plus some extra stuff too.
Yes, and I hear that it's causing a lot of controversy for certain fans that they don't like that it removes the element of surprise.
Well, yeah, I mean, but he's the boss. Let him do what he wants to do. Go see him next tour. I mean, the guy is, 60-something, and he's, I think he's in the best shape of his life, and he's making some of the best music he's made. I love the High Hopes. I love having him have Tom Morello join the E Street Band. I thought that was just a great move.
I will just be happy to. I'd just be happy to hear a Cadillac Ranch live.
Nice. And Hungry Heart, which
he
doesn't break that one out too much. But yes, what else do I got? Any other box sets?
Some of the Super Deluxe Zeppelin were pretty good, but I really love the 6-disc Bob Dylan box.
Nice.
That has all the alternates and outtakes from 1965 to 1966. And it's really different ways of looking at some of his classic albums, Bringing It All Back Home, Highway 61, Revisited, and Blonde on Blonde. And then there's something that and the Velvet Underground Matrix tapes is the best quality and complete of the shows that wound up forming the 1969 live albums. That's really excellent. And then probably one of my favorites, if not the favorite reissue of the year, is on Numero. It's the Orc Box, New York, New York. It's a bunch of early punk and power pop singles from the mid-70s, Philly Television, Richard Held, Alex Chilton,
nice.
Chris Stamey. That is wonderful. So I thoroughly
that sounds really good
for anybody that's listening.
Very cool. Yeah, I think we will be right back after this. We will get into my year-end list, and yeah, we'll be right back with Stephen Thomas Erlewine.
This episode of the Andy Dare Show is brought to you in part by Uncle Bub's award-winning barbecue in Westmont, Illinois. Family-owned and operated since 1997, Uncle Bub's is the real deal barbecue. A family-friendly restaurant, open 7 days a week. Also, it's a full-service catering company doing weddings, pig roasts, luau's, grill packages, you name it. They have a friendly, helpful staff that will make sure that your party goes off without a hitch. Call them at 630-493-9000. Visit them at 132 South Cass Avenue in Westmount, Illinois, and UncleBubs.com.
Hey man, I know you like grilling. I know you like getting those dark grill marks on your burgers, fish, chicken. And I know you don't want to just dry your meat out like you're cooking with a hairdryer. Why not get the Man Grate and click through the AndyDareShow.com's banner so we can keep the lights on here at Honeycomb Hideout Studios in gorgeous Westmont, Illinois. The Man Grate.
This episode of the Andy Dare Show is brought to you in part by Record Utopia, a music lover's dream with thousands of vinyl records, musical instruments, and sound gear. They buy, sell, and trade. Give them a call at 630-963-1957. Visit them in Westmont, Illinois at 309 West Ogden Avenue, on the web at recordutopia.com. It's always a good, relaxed atmosphere. Check them out, Record Utopia.
Yo, what goes on, people? Jay Porks here. Just reminding you to keep it locked to the Deer Network throughout 2015, where you can get the Tyler Kale Show, the smooth, sultry tones of the Jay Porks Experience, or the Andy Deer Show. Keep it locked to AndyDeer.com. 2015, big things coming.
Okay, and we are back with Stephen Thomas Erlewine. This is our Year in Rock 2015 wrap-up, and I thought it was a banner year, a lot of cool releases. Allmusic.com, a lot of stuff from Tom Erlewine is on there. Stuff from his Roby writing gets used on Allmusic.com, and so they're slowly bringing out their year-end list, right?
Correct. We have the overall list showing up, and then I'm not sure when you're posting this podcast, but I think our individual lists will show up on Monday the 14th.
Nice. And that's smart, so then there's a little reason to come back every day. I think a lot of sites have done that, right?
Yep, and we're also going to do specific styles along the way.
It is tough when you're throwing in rap with country and rock and saying that one's better than the other. It is kind of a hard list to do, like the Rolling Stone, where they still stick with just doing the top, 40 or 30 albums.
Yeah, it's just difficult in general. Just there's so much music and from so many different styles, and there's different sensibilities, and I like a lot of different ones of these sensibilities. But it can be just hard to exhaustive to go all through everything.
Yeah. Do you get a lot of people giving you like recommendations, like so much that you can't even get to everything?
Oh, of course. I mean, like like the stuff that I know I want to get to, I can't always have time to get to it because, you know, you might have listening time for things you have to cover for work reasons, or you just need a little bit of a break.
Yep, definitely. Yeah, but I picked 20, as I have been doing. It's actually going to be 20 years this year, since 1995. It's been a great year. I'm going to start off with a rocker, Local H, with their Hey Killer album. Just saw them 2 weeks ago in Palatine, Illinois. I just love Scott Lucas because he brings back that rock and roll. A funny thing he does is after every show, he crowd surfs his way to the merch table and then sells merch to you. And I just love that hustle, 20 years that he's been doing that, and 25 years actually. And it's something that, you know, it's not played on MTV or played on the radio that much, but it is satisfying meat and potatoes, grunge rock and roll, and I thought this was an especially strong album for them.
My friend and colleague Mark Deming is a huge fan of them.
Nice.
Very big on this record as well.
And he also made a splash, I believe it was April, went to go see them in Bolingbrook, Illinois. Everybody's got their phones out. And he's a notorious cell phone hater, Scott Lucas. And a guy had to be in his 50s. He's up, you know, up in the front row, just pretty much filming the whole thing. And Scott gives him a look, and I just had a weird tingly sense. And then about two songs later, he walks over to the guy, grabs the phone, whips it behind the drum kit. And everybody, you know, it causes an uproar and stuff like that. Then he did apologize for it. A couple songs later, said he'll buy him a phone if it's broken, but he just wants us to be in the moment. And I did think that I could see both sides of that, where that's a cool punk rock moment. And also, it's kind of, this guy paid money to go see you play live, leave his phone alone. It's also the cat out of the bag in 2015 with that.
Yeah, but I still can also agree with not wanting to have your performance up on YouTube without you having your own say so.
That is true. I can definitely see both sides of the story.
I can also understand that.
Nice. But yeah, my 19 is also a guy that took a lot of flack this year. He's a notorious, don't want to say asshole, but he's outspoken in between songs. A lot of stage banter from this guy. But he actually had the number one album for me last year. It's Sunkill Moon with Universal Truths, or Universal Themes, excuse me. I didn't think it was as strong as Benji, but I also thought it was more experimental. I love hearing him with Steve Shelley more up in the mix. It's less folky. It's more psych rock. It's just an interesting album, and I thought it was a contender for one of the best albums of the year.
I have not heard this particular one.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't right of him to, you know, talk all that nonsense about Laura Snapes on stage, which I can see the outroar over that. But I can also tell you right now, Kanye West is a jerk, and he makes great albums. The Morrissey, not a guy I want to hang out with, makes great albums. It's happened quite a bit in rock and roll and art in general. So, yeah, my number 18, a guy that caused about the same amount of controversy, but back in 1996, got to see him with the Smashing Pumpkins this year, rocking the dad bod. He's even more scary and menacing now that he's gained some weight and he's gained a little years on him. Marilyn Manson with The Pale Emperor.
You know, I've heard that this record's really good, and it's been on my to listen to for a while now, but I actually haven't gotten a chance to hear it. But everybody that, you know, he's gotten great reviews, and because he's had a rough few years, and I'm sort of glad that he's had it.
Yeah, his last two records I never even listened to. I heard they're pretty generic, but this
there's
one
moment, but they're a little bit bad.
Yeah. Yeah, but this one, he comes back. He's got a good sounding production, good tight band behind him. And yeah, a little stronger songwriting than those past couple albums. And it's good to see. Yeah, when he played live, I thought it was my first time seeing him. I've never been a huge fan. I've always respected him from afar. But when you come out on stilts and do Sweet Dreams, you're putting in work in front of the crowd. And that's something that I'll always respect, you know?
Yeah.
Number 17, the previously mentioned Keith Richards with his Cross-Eyed Heart. I thought this was a really strong collection. The production is very raw and rough, and I love it. And with the Norah Jones, that was a great collaboration that I did not expect to be so intense. I thought it was great album. Yeah.
No, I think that I really like the feel of it, and I'm like – sort of holding out hope that the Rolling Stones record that's allegedly happening kind of follows in the footsteps, because I think that it could be nice and laid back and more about vibe than trying to have hits, and I think that could be a great thing for them to do.
Yeah, Mick brings the kind of the striving for the hits, like his solo album, Goddess in the Doorway or something. But Keith always brings that. He's still true to his original game plan, it seems like. So it'd be cool if Keith got to take the helm on the new album. I think
I have to get the feeling that Nick is also realizing that they're not going to have hits. Just I think that he's smart enough to know that he'd be better off like just going ahead and maybe doing a nice low-key sort of feel. That I personally kind of hold out hope that they're going to book in their career by doing a blues album.
I think that would be amazing, yeah.
That would be a wonderful way for them to go, and I sort of hope that's what happens.
Nice. And, my next offering, Neil Young in The Promise of the Real with the Monsanto Years. This is just such another interesting left turn, a whole album about the Monsanto thing that's happening with bio-engineered food, and the DVD that comes with it is great. It's a really energetic performance. He's backed by Willie Nelson's sons, and they bring a lot of life back to Neil. It's just an interesting I like when they're recording in the bathroom trying to get vocals done by singing into a urinal. I thought that was just, wow, you'll do anything for the perfect sound. And Neil, what can you say? Last year he did a song in a vinyl recording booth. Now he's doing an album about Monsanto. Of course, the critics didn't really give it a lot of love, but it got a lot of love over here, so.
Well, this is actually one of my favorite of Neil's recent ones, because I think that it's there's a couple of good songs on it, but I enjoy the overall feel, and it's like one of his fun, weird ones again. Like,
yeah.
Sometimes his detours aren't that fun, and sometimes they really are. And this one, to me, is one of his better detours of late.
It does. It reminds me, The Promise of the Real kind of remind me of when he was backed by Pearl Jam for the Mirror Ball album.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. It's just loud rock, and it's an interesting left turn, but as you said, it's a fun one. It's not, Story Tone was a little bloated for me.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of Story Tone. It's an okay record, but I don't ever want to put it on.
No, yeah, I don't really return to it too much. But this one, I think I will be returning to it. Okay, how about the next one, Tame Impala with Currents. This really did get a lot of love. Very electronic. He's got some great songwriting behind it. But the electronics on the album, they're warm and analog. And it's not like something that somebody cooked up on a laptop. It's something that sounds like it was, created in the late 70s with the help of Eno or something like that. It's a lot of interesting textures on there.
I like it pretty well, and I keep thinking that if I spend more time with it, it's going to sink in more. And I just unfortunately haven't had a lot of time to have it sink in.
Nice. And my next one. Brandon Flowers, the singer of The Killers, with his album called The Desired Effects. This one, I wanted to dislike it, but it's so campy and so cheesy, and he's got one song that sounds like Dire Straits meets Bruce Springsteen meets the Pet Shop Boys, and it's just it's very, very fun album. Have you been able to check this one out?
That's actually maybe my favorite thing that Brandon Flowers has ever done. I like that it's really over the top glam art pop, and it's like it has the courage of its convictions, and it really works.
It captures the optimism of an era, like the late 80s going into the early 90s, and I just think he hit it out the park. And it's not something that Scott Weiland, maybe if he was in a better state, he could have tried something like this.
More focused.
Yeah, exactly. He could have done something like this, but Brandon Flowers put in a lot of work to make it definitely sound like something of the era, not something that is an homage to an era, which paid off in spades. I like somebody said, oh, it sounds like Bruce Hornsby in places, and I say that's because Bruce Hornsby is on it. And I've never been a humongous Killers or Brandon fan, but this one is definitely pushing me towards being one. Yeah. And the next one, New Order with Music Complete. Really didn't get a lot of play, didn't get a lot of press. It was weird to see Peter Hook, sending his lawyers on the guys. I thought it was an awesome return to dance pop, and it doesn't have any of that really that rock that Peter Hook would bring to the band. But I think the production sound big and vibrant and expensive, and I definitely liked it. Were you a fan?
I have not heard it yet. It's still on my to-do list.
It's weird that Bernard Sumner is going to be turning 60 next year, and he's pumping out mall pop, but it's mall pop that has teeth. It's something that it sounds like something that would be played at the Hacienda still, and it's just an interesting listen. I don't think it got the play or the love it deserves. So,
all right, what else we got?
My number 11. This is another bright, vibrant work. It seems like 2015, the bright, vibrant year for pop music in general. Coldplay with their A Head Full of Dreams.
I like how it's so thoroughly post-divorce album. Right? It seems to be embracing every new day and think it's an adventure of a lifetime. It reminds me of Steve Winwood's Back in the High Life that
yeah.
way.
Yeah, I mean, the Ghost Stories, I have a friend who really loves the Ghost Stories, which I was an okay fan of, but I went back and it actually does have some interesting stuff, but it's cold, it's dark, it's lonely, it's sad. It's their breakup album or their conscious uncoupling album. And this one is him having fun, going back, hitting the clubs and enjoying the single life. And it's just very colorful, a lot of life in there. Once again, they have a song called Everglow, which is straight out of the Bruce Hornsby playlist. He's really, if you would have said Bruce Hornsby would be making a comeback of coolness, I would have never have guessed it. But yeah, he's making a comeback, and Everglow just glides on a beautiful piano figure that sounds. It's one of those. How did anybody not think of that riff before? And yeah, I think there's a lot of stuff. It's weird to also hear Coldplay flirting with hip-hop and urban R&B sounds and without sounding terrible. They actually sound pretty decent, almost natural. I wouldn't call it completely natural, but almost natural. And definitely a late entry into my list. So. And it's weird, though. It seems like they would have always released a lot of albums in late November and December. Around this time, but it doesn't seem like that's happening in 2015. Are you aware of that? Or
It seems like there's just a handful of like heavy hitters like Adele and Coldplay, and I think that's very much a reflection of the realities of the business. Like everybody likes to tout surprise albums, but apart from a handful, like Beyonce, not all of them sell especially well, and it's good to have a little bit of marketing if you're going into the big holiday season, which Coldplay and Adele both have.
That's very true. Okay, my top 10. Here is Courtney Barnett. Sometimes I sit and think, sometimes I just sit. My friend saw her open for Blur at the Hollywood Bowl and said it was amazing. What can you say about Courtney Barnett? It's almost like Courtney Love if she got her shit together. Great songwriting, totally fresh new voice on the scene. I hadn't heard of her since this year. I know she has one other debut album, but it was great.
This is the first to come out over here, and I just love her. That's my favorite record of the year. I think she writes great song. She's funny and distinctive as a lyricist, and the band really rocks. I saw them live this year doing the record, and it was one of the best shows of the year. I think it's a terrific record.
That's awesome. So that's your pick for 2015.
Yeah, that went to my number one early on, and it has not been knocked off.
Beautiful. All right, my number 9, another female, another girl that kind of popped up on the scene just maybe 2-3 years ago, Lana Del Rey with her Honeymoon. It's funny, I played it for my dad. He likes down-tempo female stuff, and He goes, this one's too down-tempo for me. And I said, it is true. You're always waiting for it to kick in, and it doesn't quite ever kick in, but maybe that's the point. It's just, it's almost like she's, on NyQuil or something. It's just very subdued, but that voice, it towers above the arrangements. It really, it just gives chills down your spine. And I don't know much about her since before Born to Die came out. I know it hit the scene and it was a lot of articles written about her, but not a lot of airplay, not a lot of interviews or anything like that, but a
lot of online stuff. She's been she's really smart in how she controls her image. And I think that she's been smart in developing her career, like getting the remix of Summertime Sadness that actually gave her a real hit, and then working with Dan Auerbach on Ultraviolence last year, which is a record I prefer.
I would have asked her to keep working with Auerbach just because I did like hearing those guitars more up in the mix. But this one, she went back to her original collaborator, correct?
And that said, I am, again, very much admiring her control.
Of course.
That she knows precisely what she's doing, and I she's carved out a very distinctive niche for herself, and so I'm all for that.
And it's weird. I mean, you could almost say she's similar to Adele. I mean, I was going to ask you, is Adele worth the fuss, or does she just have a huge team behind her pushing her, or are you going to put her in the top, in your top 10 or top 5? Is this
personally? No. I mean, I like her. I don't like this record as much as the last one, partially because it's very much reliant on ballads and it feels a little samey, but she has, she sings really well. She's a phenomenal singer. And I think that it's not just that she has a team. It's, that she actually really does resonate with a lot of people.
Yeah. It does seem like that nowadays.
Because I think that she has this, she has a quality to her voice that is pretty authentic seeming that can resonates to a lot of different people, both adults and millennials. And so what she's wound up, I think it's pretty amazing how she's done that. I think that's cool.
Lana Del Rey, if she didn't have this image as like, I don't want to say slutty, but just looking like a cocktail waitress or something like that. She's got kind of this cutting edge look to her that Adele does not have. I wonder if, maybe the older generations would be more into Lana just because she does have that classic voice. She's not pushing the envelope too hard. But then I guess she does have some lyrics on these albums that, even though she's singing like an angel, some of these lyrics are straight out of, like, what is she up to, kind of.
Yeah, right? I think that Lana Del Rey very consciously pushes taboo buttons.
Yeah.
Whereas Adele goes for a broad audience.
Bigger statements, yeah.
So, I think that both are poised to be around for a long time. Lana Del Rey, I don't think she's going to burn out because I think she's too smart for that. I think she knows, this wasn't quite as big of a hit as the first album is still selling best of all, but I think that suggests she's going to be able to continue to work this very distinctive persona for a while, whereas Adele, I think, is going to be there forever.
And Lana, you don't ever see the world tour or any shows. I don't see that much, right?
There was going to be a tour with Courtney Love, but I don't know how that went.
Yeah, that would have been very interesting. Okay, my next one. Not a lot of hip-hop out this year, but this guy, what can you say? He sings, he raps, he's a likable guy when he's like on Saturday Night Live and stuff. Drake, with If you're reading this, it's too late. And like I've done in previous lists, I'll sandwich that in with his album with Future, What a Time to Be Alive. Future is one of those guys where a lot of press, a lot of stuff like that, and just completely auto-tuned and just really dark lyrics, just completely about Percocet, codeine, all sex, all violence, all this stuff, but he auto-tunes it, so I don't think people really know exactly what he's talking about. And I feel like Drake is the guy who's the leader of the class. He's got he's actually shown chops. He's been in the game for 6 or 7 years now. He doesn't show any signs of slowing down. He's a hard worker. This was both of these actually were just mixtape only when they first showed up on the scene. And now that Drake album has been pressed up, and I think it's one of the biggest sellers of the year. It's great. There's not a lot of hooks to it. There's funny lyrics. There's catchy melodies and interesting beats. And talk about his previous, or actually current record label, Cash Money Records, which I believe stopped paying him a couple years ago or something like that. So it's just an interesting place to be as an artist.
Yeah, I don't get into Drake. I keep trying, but he's not somebody that does a lot for me.
Something about him, I feel like there's not a lot of new voices that are interesting in rap, and I think he's one that's got the brightest future ahead for him. I think we're just seeing his first act, really. So, my next one, this is a guy that kind of showed up out of nowhere. Last couple of years, he showed up on the scene with some, you know, soft, weird deep house instrumentals, kind of like stuff from Canada. The Weeknd with his album called Beauty Behind the Madness, and he just exploded, the guy with the hair. And yeah, huge song co-written by Max Martin of the whole Britney Spears NSYNC movement. But Can't Feel My Face sounds like something out of the Michael Jackson songbook. And he had not only that, but he had probably 3 or 4 other hits off the album. And he seems like a talent that is just beginning as well.
Yeah, I really like that single a lot.
Yeah, and it's cool because he really came from more of an auteur side, like Lana Del Rey and all that stuff with his first mixtapes and stuff like that. And then he just decided he wanted to be a pop star last year. And it's interesting. And once again, he seems like he's got a lot of feel to his vocals and a lot of interesting stuff going on in the production. So, this album, it seems like it's another interesting piece of current modern R&B. My next one, you couldn't go any more different way about it. Slater Kinney with their huge comeback this year. I'm sure Portlandia didn't hurt and stuff like that, but it had been 10 years since their previous album. And it was nice they didn't go from their stripped back, you know, female John Spencer blues explosion sound of their early 90s or mid 90s work. This is completely loud. It's vibrant. It's got a beautiful production to it. And No Cities to Love. Were you a fan of this?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that. I think it's a really muscular and invigorating record, and I like that they seem older but no less vital. And I'm a fan of Carrie Brownstein's memoir as well.
That's supposed to be great. That's a good read.
Yeah, I thoroughly recommend that. It's a lot of good autobiographies this year, and that's one of them.
Riot Girl Movement from the early 90s. I think that they would have to respect this album, even though it doesn't completely stick to just punk roots. They try a whole bunch of stuff. It's not exactly like there's ballads on it or anything, but there is like little electronic underpinnings on stuff, and it's still not anywhere near a sellout move for the ladies, right?
No.
Yeah, very raw. And that brings us to my number 5. This guy is just a huge talent for me. I think this is a great work from the man, Kurt Vile, Believe I'm Going Down.
I like that record a lot, too. I like that it's very different than the previous one, and it's sort of more shambolic and more acoustic. I think it's a really good vibe and good songs as well.
A lot of great songs on there. Pretty Pimpin', that was a great first selection from the album. I feel like if we're going to have another Neil Young, there's only one choice. It's Kurt Vile. The guy remains raw, but has songs behind all the noise. And that's a very important thing. And I love how the guy can just go you know, they'll have four or five songs on each album where it's just acoustic, and they're just as good as the rockers. And I think that's important when the guy can just strip away everything, just go out there with a guitar and still keep your attention. Which is something Neil and Bob Dylan, they built their career on that, doing two sides of the coin. So my number four, this guy took very long to create his follow-up, his third studio album in 23 years, even more than My Bloody Valentine, Dr. Dre with his Compton, a soundtrack album. And I think it doesn't sound anything like a soundtrack. It holds together as a piece of work. And I think Dre is great because he's not trying to hold on to the sound of 1992. He's not trying to hold on to the sound of 1999 either. He's tapped into Kendrick Lamar. He's got a couple new guys on here that sound like they could be molded into stars. He's not interested, even though he does have Snoop and stuff on this album. He definitely seems like his eyes are on the future. And I'm sure it didn't really get the love it deserved after, but that's what happens when you wait that long, like My Bloody Valentine's MBV album 2 years ago. You end up not getting the huge response that you wanted, but this is a totally quality work from Dre.
Oh, sure. And it's also it's also exclusive to one streaming service. It doesn't necessarily go out into the public the way that it's
the mass consciousness. No, yeah. It's not like when the Chronic dropped and that was in every single store across the nation.
Yeah.
This is more of a, you had to go find it, and great movie along with it. It was an interesting year. This album, it's, the beats are textured. He put a lot of work into it. It's got that cinematic vibe to it. Eminem is the only, I don't know, Eminem the last couple years, he's just shouted into the microphone, sobering shouts of how much it sucks to be famous and all this stuff. And I don't know, Eminem used to be fun. He's not as fun as anymore. But I don't know, Kendrick Lamar, these new guys, it sounds like something that Dre has found the next generation, and hopefully he can, not take as long to record his next thing.
Yeah.
I think this was not a letdown at all. It's just maybe the way that people are doing the exclusive releases. You think that's going to be happening more and more in the future? Are the big bands going to find the next streaming service?
Yeah. I don't think it's going to happen as much as people think. I think there will always be some of it, but I think that the sales of Adele will prove that it's best to try to be out to as many people as possible.
I think that's actually a really good point. Do you think he made less money than if he would have gone the normal route?
Probably not, because I think that if it would not have sold in blockbuster numbers, I think he was better off getting a guaranteed payday than
that is true. Okay, nice. All right, number three, one of these surprise releases, which are also prevalent these days, Wilco with Star Wars. I thought it's one of their strongest short little compact releases since, I don't know, they've never been known to do a little short album, compact and everything, and poppy and condensed into, 12 little songs. I think this is they pick quality over quantity, and I think it's a really sharp effort from the guys from Chicago.
I find it one of their more likable records, and I like them better in this mode than when they're super ambitious.
Yeah, I mean, you can say everything you want about Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. I think that's probably still their crowning achievement, or being there was great as well, more sprawling. But maybe the smaller little loud albums are in their future, and it's pretty cool. That's how they celebrated their 20 years of existence. Doing a surprise release to, and then a really cool thing that they did was after they gave everybody the album in their inbox, they sent an email saying that you should support these smaller, lesser known bands that have also released albums, like your 11th Dream Day and more hard to find stuff like that. And I thought that was just a really nice call on behalf of the guys from Wilco, because shows, hey, we're at this position where we can do this, but these other bands aren't. So why don't you take the $20 you were going to spend on our album and give it to them? So.
Yeah, I thought that was a really nice way to do it, too. So.
Very classy. And, yeah, just two left. Kendrick Lamar, everywhere this year, even though was there even like a pop hit on this album? I mean, there was, I'm sure there
not,
was.
I really know of.
Not really, right?
But nothing crossover.
Nothing crossed over, but the album was all on everybody's mind, everybody talking about it. Was this surprise release, or it was, announced a couple days before?
It was half surprise, because, I mean, people knew that it was in the works, but it was very sudden when it was actually out.
And once again, Dr. Dre's name is on this. Very smart. Very political on a year where politics were everywhere, especially the whole racial debate. Once again, it's up. And this album kind of hit the chord. It hit the zeitgeist perfectly. The productions are widely varied. Once again, no pop. It's more of just conscious rap that, you know, Common's been touting for a decade and a half now, but never with the gusto that Kendrick is doing. I mean, he's a young man. He's got a lot on his mind. And I like to say it's a little bit too Def Jam poetic slam for me. It's a little bit too much verbiage thrown in my face. But at the same time, I think that's something that will give it a lot of more staying power. You'll always go back and find lines you never heard before. And I think that's just an interesting thing. Really hit the nail on the head for 2015.
Yeah, I think it's great. It's in my top 10 as well.
And I'd say one of the more iconic album covers of the year as well. So.
Sure.
And, before we do my number one, anything do you want to give maybe a couple out of your top 10? You don't need to spoil it, but maybe a couple maybe that I did not hit on?
Well, sure. As I mentioned toward the beginning of the podcast, I am a really big fan of Low Cut Connie, who's out of Philadelphia. And their album Hi Honey is a really fun, sleazy little rock and roll record. Adam Wiener, one of the two leaders, plays piano, and you don't hear a lot of really good rock and roll piano these days. And so
nice.
I give that a plug. And I like the Natalie Prass album. It reminds me of a Laurel Canyon singer-songwriter record from the 70s quite a bit. Squeeze's Cradle to the Grave is a great comeback record from Difford and Tilbrook. I thoroughly recommend it. For 90s veterans, I really liked Juliana Hatfield III's Whatever My Love, which I think is better than Become What You Are, their 94 album. And Veruca Salt's Ghost Notes is a great record, too.
Ghost Notes is awesome, too. I completely forgot about that one. Nice.
And the Sonics, a proto-punk garage rock band out of Seattle, they're all in their 60s and 70s, put out a killer record called This Is the Sonics. They sound way younger than their years, and it's a really vital, fun record. And
that's pretty awesome. They really kind of laid down the work for the Stooges, and then, you know, something in every decade. Then you had the grunge movement was highly indebted to the Sonics, and I first heard of them on the Nuggets box set.
Yep.
You know,
and it's amazing how good they sound here. And then finally, there's a band called White Reaper with their second album, White Reaper Does It Again, which is another garagey kind of record that's really good.
That's pretty awesome. Cool. And as we said, you can go to allmusic.com and see and go back each day, and there will be a new list. Tons of stuff to check out. I've just barely scratched the top of the surface here. My number one album of 2015. We've talked before. You know me too well to know that I'd pick anything else than this. Great to see the whole original quartet back together. Great to see. It was weird that they started with sessions that were also that they stopped for a while, and they didn't think that the music would be released until the singer gave the guitarist the recordings and said, "Why don't you take a whack at it and see if you can bring these to life?" He did. Blur with the Magic Whip.
It's a really good record. I was surprised how coherent it sounds given like how what you were describing as the creative process, it's not something that you would normally think that they would actually be able to pull something together, but it's a very, very good record that I think picks up where they left off when Graham Coxon left the band, and shows exactly how much they all owe each other. So
yeah, it takes bits from each of their previous albums, but it's its own creation, and it's also just great to hear Graham's guitar squiggles with Damon Albarn. I mean, Graham's solo albums are awesome, but they're very much, you know, in that post-punk vibe, not really reaching for a pop sound at all. You really need Albarn's pop sense combined with Graham Coxon's post-punk sense to really create the Blur sound. And I like it. It's very similar to their self-titled album from 97.
Yep.
Kind of their more expansive sounds from 1999's 13 album. Even he throws in a little bit of Gorillaz with like the Ice Cream Man has a kind of a loping hip hop beat to it. I definitely think that I wish they would have done a world tour with that, or at least toured the States more. They only played a handful of shows, but Damon's got a million irons in the fire. He's already recording the next Gorillaz. I really loved his solo album from last year. Collaborations with a whole bunch of different people. So it was nice that he took the time out to, if this is the final Blur album, it was nice of Damon to give us this, and not a bad way to go out on. Mirrorball is a great closing number on the album. Hopefully it's not the last, but yeah, it will be. It's always interesting to see his trajectory, where he'll take it next, you know.
Yeah, I would not be surprised if they continue working in some fashion. I don't think it'll be a yearly thing, but I think it's going to be in the rotation of Damon's projects.
Yes, I'm hoping so. And maybe the next one they will all do in the same room instead of bits and pieces pieced together like they did in Hong Kong for this one. But great set of songs, great sounds. I'm glad to have them back. And yeah, I just want to thank everybody for checking out this show. We've had a nice year here, almost 5 years we've been doing it. Tom, you've been a great returning guest. As I've said on the show before, my dad got me the book in like 1997. It's still sitting in my living room. The cover it's not ripped off. It fell off from usage. And that's always a good sign. And always keep going back, checking the websites, checking the writing. If they want to know more about you, is Medium a good place too? Are you going to be doing more articles out there?
I'll probably throw some stuff up out there, but I can be reached on Twitter and Facebook.
Nice. St. Erlewin. We will have obviously links to that in the show notes. Do check it out. It's great non-biased music reporting, great album reviews that I check almost on a daily basis.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for coming by again. I do appreciate it. Any last words?
No, it's always a pleasure, and I really appreciate you having me back on, and I always like doing this. So.
Very awesome. So if we don't talk, happy holidays to you and your family. And on behalf of Stephen Thomas Erlewin, this is Andy signing off for the Andy Derer Show.
This has been a presentation of The Andy Derer Show, copyright 2015. For more info, check out andyderer.com. Thank you so much for listening.